Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
And we are back. We are live this evening. It's Tuesday, May 6th. And I'm so happy to be back on this platform I have called The Break Room. Now, Jenny.
Are we live, really?
We're live, mama. We're live. And say vivo, vivo.
En vivo.
See, the reason why I call this platform I have The Break Room is because, and I spell it B-R-A-K-E. And the reason why I spell it that way is I feel like sometimes in life we just stop, take a break, you know, and reassess where we are in life and where we're going. So, and I feel like as people, we don't reflect enough about where we've been and where we're going. So if you indulge me for like an hour, I want to talk to you just about life and about things and about you. I want to reconnect with you because it's been a long time since we've been around each other. And I want to learn from you this evening. Jenny, it's Jenny. How are you doing? Jenny from the block. Okay. Now, let me give some backstory to you from my perspective. I met you, I want to say, 2011-ish. Wow, it's like almost 15 years ago.
No, it wasn't 2011. It was before that.
You think so?
Yeah.
Okay. Something like that. 2010, 20, something like that. Well,
When did you start?
Well, I started in 2010.
So it was in 2010?
Yeah, 2010, yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm 2010. Wow, 15 years ago. Quintanio. So.
Wow, really?
That's how old we've gotten. We are old people now.
You're old. Look at me. I am the same age.
Okay. you're a vampiro. You're a vampire. You stay the same. All right. Nah, but you look great. So I'll give you that. Well, 15 years ago, me and you first met. And when I met you, you were already an educator, already a teacher. And you are someone, I want to give you some credit here. Because when I came to the school, you were someone who's only a year older than me. So we're the same age. But you are someone that was already a
professor. Really? How old are you, Mike?
I'll be 40 this November.
We're not the same age. You're older than me.
That's right. You're only 25 years old. So you were like you were 10 years old back then teaching. 30. Okay. So you were 15. You were 15 years old already with your degree teaching back then. You stupid. You were a 15 year old back then teaching early. And I must say, when I first met you. And I got to see, because I had the privilege of working with you for like the rest of the school year. And I have to say, even back then, I was so impressed by you. And I was so impressed by your work ethic, your diligence, the way you were able to be a class manager and just navigate these children and give order, but with love. To the point where even after you left, like all the kids, Jason, Claudio, they would always ask about you. They always would wonder about you and ask me about you. Because you left the imprint early on these children's lives. So, and I knew it then as it was happening live, Jose. I knew it then when it was happening live because I could see how you were great at giving empathy to children. Can I ask you your journey as far as why did I see that 15 years ago? What is it about you that made you great as a teacher back then?
So when I started teaching, my plan was never in my life to become a teacher. I wanted to be a clinical psychologist. That's what I wanted to do, or work for the FBI or something related with law enforcement. And then I had my son, 21. I was finishing my bachelor's degree. So I decided to go into counseling because that would give me, you know, according to everybody, you know, I'm going to have the summers off to be with my child. And I'm going to be home around the same time he's home. So I decided to, instead of going with clinical psychology, to do school counseling. And you know that for you to get a school counselor position in public school, it has to be, you know, like somebody has to die or somebody's retiring or somebody's moving to a different country because those jobs are very, very good and easy. And people usually don't just leave them like that unless, right. You know, like I said, they're ready to retire. So when I was doing my internship, well, I ended up in the Department of Education as a substitute paraprofessional.
Right.
And I did that for maybe 2 years, subbing.
Okay. So you were subbing for 2 years, roughly.
Let me see. It's probably 1 to 2. Yeah, I'm going to say 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I was at a different school. And this other school that I was at, I don't remember what kind of behavior that the students had, but they were fighting every single day. I remember that I used to get home with a headache every day. And then there came a time where they were hiring permanent, and I didn't get a position. So I was so heartbroken. I was so sad. I'm like, you know, I have more credentials than this person, and they didn't hire me. I was at 186. I think it's by Jennings, something like that. And then it's when they switched the system to where they will call you from any school in the city. And I ended up accepting a position at, an assignment at 176.
Right, right.
And, you know, I fell in love with the kids.
Right, right.
There was a teacher there that her paraprofessional, I don't know, was on leave or something. So I stayed with her. I went subbing for like 1 or 2 days and I stayed with her for the rest of the year. And then they made me a permanent teacher's assistant.
Wow.
And when I was there, you know, I knew that getting a counselor's job was going to be extremely almost close to impossible. Right. So I decided to, once I finished my master's in counseling, start taking classes, doing another master's in special education.
Where were you going to school? Where were you going to school?
Mercy College. It's not Mercy University, by the way.
Mercy College, okay.
Yeah. So I started taking classes in special education and then took a whole bunch of tests, ended up teaching. I really fell in love with the kids. I really did. Yeah. And, you know, I was always into looking for quotes and things like that. And one that I remember I used to put on everything, that every communication that I would send to the parents or like any email, anything that would like be going from me to anybody, I will put a quote. I don't remember who said it, but it's something like they might not remember what you teach them, but they will always remember how you make them feel. So, you know, that was like my motto. That was like, you know, my main focus with them was to make sure that they remember how I made them feel, make sure that I treated them the same way anybody, you know, without a disability will be treated, that I treated them with love. And I see that in my kids. I know that my kids, well, at that time they were our kids too. From that point on, I didn't hear anything, any complaints or any reports of those behaviors that they had before coming to my class. So I you know, it's just the love that I have for them.
Sure. Really. Yeah, you always treated the kids with dignity, you know? Respect.
But I was not easy. I was very tough.
No? Yeah, you were very tough. That's part of, in my opinion, showing dignity to these to our children, to our population, of not treating them like they deserve to have slack or deserve to get a break. You know, you always made sure that these kids were held to a standard. And I saw it then, like, okay, the way she has expectations of them, that's the way you have to treat this job. So I learned that from you early on. Like, just because you are on the spectrum, and now I'm a father of someone on the spectrum, so I have to learn this at home too. But just because you are teaching children on the spectrum or with disabilities doesn't mean you have to, like, you know, make excuses for them, you know? So I learned that from you early on as a professional. I respect you for that and thank you for that. Okay. Now, before you were teaching, you have this beautiful accent. Before you were teaching, you weren't always here in America. Like, I know you have a history, and is it the Army or the Reserves? I might have lost you, Jay.
You froze. I don't know if you can hear me, but you froze.
Did I lose you?
No, I'm here.
Oh, no. Yeah.
You froze for a second.
Okay. Before teaching, I remember you telling me you had a history in the Army, or is it the Reserves?
In the Army.
So you're a veteran.
Yes.
Okay. Tell me about being a veteran and what was like that. What was that experience like for you, being in the Army?
I am a veteran, because I was during the period of time. But I didn't complete the 4-year term. I got a medical discharge.
Okay.
But I think being in the Army is what changed my life. So, you know, I came when I was 14, and then at 15 became a teacher.
It's life, okay. I'm here now. First week, let's go to school.
I was 13, almost 14 years old when I came to the U.S.
What part of DR?
From Bani.
Okay. I always hear about Bani. Okay. I always hear about that town. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so when I came here, I went straight to high school, ninth grade. And it wasn't, things were different back then. It's not like right now. Like I remember in my science class, my teacher didn't speak Spanish. Like we didn't have all those accommodations that students have nowadays. And you know, I had to struggle a lot in school, learning the language.
What was that like for you? What was that like for you, the language barrier? What was that like for you coming here in your teenage years?
I don't know. I don't know. Like, I like to read. I like literature. And it was so funny because when I was like my first semester in college, I was in honors English literature. So everybody was like, how was she in honors English when she barely can speak?
Yeah.
But I used to write well, and I always liked to read and going to the learning center, to the resource center, you know, so that they correct my papers and things like that. But it was a challenge. I think that if I came during this time, it would be a little bit more challenging because everywhere you go, you're going to find somebody that speaks Spanish.
Okay.
There's so many radio stations, Spanish speaking, internet, everything is like so easy now, as far as that for me, in my point of view. But back then, I remember that maybe we had two Spanish radio stations, and people in the street, they didn't speak. You didn't find that many Spanish-speaking people anywhere you went. Or if you go to a government office, you know, you had to. If you needed an interpreter, you had to bring your own interpreters. It was a little bit of a challenge, but because I like to read, I was more like self-teaching myself, like, you know, reading a lot. Buying books to study. Really, I don't know. I don't think challenge-wise, I can tell you like if it was extremely difficult. I just know that I did it.
Right,
And then when I finished high school, my father used to be in the military at some point in Dominican Republic. I saw him, you know, like with the friends and the lifestyle and so on that, you know, that got into my mind. And when I was old enough, I'm like, you know, I want to go to the army. I finished high school when I was 17, and my mother didn't want me to go to the army.
Really? Why not?
So she's like, no. It was right after I joined the army, right after 9/11, like a couple of months after 9/11.
My God, what a time to join.
So she was like freaking out. And as soon as I turned 18, I did one semester in college, and I'm like, you know, I'm signing my own papers now, like, you know, right. I didn't need my mother, but my father was always on my side. Like, he always loved that, so he was fine with that. And I was there for a couple of months. I didn't even stay there for a year, but it was a very good experience because being there, another place where either you speak it or, like, you sink or swim or sink. Like, yeah, that's what it was. Like, there was nobody. I think one of the sergeants, he was Mexican, and he was like, vas a estar bien, loquita. And then he would translate a few things here and then, but that was about it. So it was a really good experience for me as far as, like, learning the language, discipline, and more discipline.
What time y'all wake up in the morning? What was a daily life like for?
You know, I'm an old person now. Like, I have memory problems. I don't remember.
You watch army movies on TV. It's like you wake up.
It's like 4 o'clock in the morning. I think like something like that. Like yeah, like super super early. Like I remember 4:30. We had to be somewhere, so we would wake up around that time, like 4 in the morning.
What was it like learning artillery, learning guns, learning? What was that like?
It was fascinating for me. And let me tell you something. I got like this little medal.
That smile on your face. It's scary. When I said gun, you like cheesing. She's like, oh, yes. I remember my guns. Oh, yes, yes. In my purse right now. What was that like, though? Like learning artillery, learning guns, and learning how to clean guns, use guns. What was that like?
I loved it. It was.
Yeah.
I really loved it. Yeah.
I could tell. Yeah. So you know, you watch the movies and you see like people like learning how to clean their gun and use it and disassemble it and put it back together. It looks cool. But it's also like, man, it also puts you in a mentality of like, you got to be ready to defend yourself.
Mm-hmm.
God forbid something happens, you know? Okay, interesting. Army life.
Hey, I got a little medal I was not a sniper, but I was like a level below that.
Really?
So I was really good with that, yeah.
Did you have to go out and do a tour?
No, I didn't have to go out. I was all during training.
Okay, all during training, okay. So you never had to see combat?
No.
Thank God, no. Okay, cool. So you did your little bid in the Army, and then you went on medical, okay, and then you came back to America and started doing your thing. Okay. I want to ask you, because you mentioned, is it Bani?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell me, as someone who is from America, born and raised, my parents are from Haiti, but I'm a gringo. I'm straight up born and raised here. Now, I have my mother's culture, of course, where I learn things here and there. I have the language inside of me. I have the food inside of me. But I don't have the on-the-island experience, living there day to day. Can you tell me what it was like growing up in DR before you left? What was that like for you?
It was really nice. My mom was very protective. I didn't remember going to any parties, they do over there, las fiestas patronales. Those are like the community, like they take one whole week or a couple of days to do like partying, event drinking. They sell food, they bring different artists, and they do that once a year. I don't remember that I was even allowed to go to any of those things.
Really?
She was very protective. So over there, and we were very innocent, you know, climbing up the woods, climbing up the trees. I was very como un tomboy.
Oh, okay. I could see that. I could see that.
Yeah, like going to the river, climbing up the things. It was a healthy childhood. It was really nice.
I could see that. Yeah. Do you value that your mom was very protective of you, or do you feel like you wish she let you go a little bit?
No. I wouldn't change anything.
Really?
I wouldn't change anything.
I can see that. You know, you mentioned when you were talking about the language barrier earlier and just learned the language here in America when you came. It reminded me of my mother in a way, because my mom came when she was high school, 14, 15, came to Brooklyn. And because she came in high school, she was able to, you know, learn English rather quickly. Obviously, she kept her accent and stuff, but she was able to learn English rather quickly and adjust. And my dad, too. My dad came in his 20s, same thing. But, you know, mi suegra, my mother-in-law, she came to America from DR, from Boca Chica, and like in the 80s. And she was already an adult by then. So, and she went straight to Dykeman. So my mother-in-law to this day doesn't speak no English. And she's in Dykeman, where it's like, you don't need English pretty much because everything is just Spanish. So as I heard you speak to me about how, like, you know, how the culture back then for you when you came here, you had to learn to adjust to English. I wanted to ask you, do you feel it's a benefit to come into an environment in America where it's strictly dominated in one culture that you're used to? Or do you feel like more immigrants should try to learn the language of the land and try to adjust? What do you favor more? Do you feel like it's no problem as long as you have your own community and your own culture? Or do you feel people should like expand more or learn the language of the land? Or it don't matter?
I think that it depends on, you know, I'm never going to go against preparation, regardless if you think you don't need it now. Preparation is, you know, like very important. But it depends on your goals, like where you want to go in life. You know, if your goal is to, and anybody that comes to the U.S. with their mindset that they want to improve, that they want to get better, that they want to have a good job, that they want to make more money, that they want to have a better life. The age is a big factor because, you know, that especially in New York, everything is super expensive, and a lot of jobs for people that don't have a career don't really, you know, we might think, oh yeah, they're making a lot of money, but they're also spending a lot. And so, you know, they might not have that free time to go and learn something or, you know, go to school or sign up in an English course or anything like that. But I think, you know, if you put yourself in that environment where you were like forced to speak the language, it will help in the long run for you to learn faster.
That makes sense. That, like you said, it depends on the goal that you have for yourself. And, you know, I love my mother-in-law, love her to death, but I guess she was more accustomed to, like, you know, having her husband, my father-in-law, you know, take care of things and be outside and work. And she was mostly focused on just the home life. So I guess for her, she didn't have the motivation to, you know, I guess, to learn more as far as language-wise. So I get it.
Listen, my father, he was a taxi driver for like 20-something years. And he doesn't know the language, but speak to him in money language. Like, he will tell him how much, and he said $20.
That's funny.
So he knows what he needs, you know.
Everybody knows money.
Yeah.
Everybody knows money. That's funny. Well, speaking of money, so you come to America, you come to high school, and then you start working at 15. And let me ask you. So when I'm with you, I'm learning a lot from you. I remember that whole school year where we're working together, and I'm proud of you, and I'm happy to work with you. I want to say that summer, I couldn't work that summer because I was so fresh in the system. There wasn't enough spots available for me. So my old school I used to work at, they had a spot for me. So I went to work there that summer. This is like summer 2011, I think. Yeah. So I remember seeing you and being like, all right, I will see you when I get back in the fall. I remember saying to myself, okay, Jenny, I will see you when I get back. And I remember you used to always do these trips to DR every summer, you know, whether mm-hmm. for personal reasons, yeah. whether for personal reasons to hang out, whether to, you know, do work down there. I always remember you, it would be a goal of yours to go back to DR and, you know, just to, you know, have another life and, you know, contribute back to your home country. I remember coming back. I'm like, where's Jenny? I remember coming back in September. I'm like, where's Jenny? Where are you? And I hadn't heard from you in a while. Is it okay to talk about why I didn't hear from you in a while?
We can leave that for the next
time. For the next time. Well, I hadn't seen you, right. Okay, so the next time we'll talk about that. But I hadn't seen you in a while and we lost touch. And I remember for you, it was always a climb to get back to teaching because you had told, you would tell me over the years, like, I want to get back teaching. I want to get back teaching. I want to get back teaching. But I think there were so many roadblocks for you. Like I think you had to like do the testing over again. And there were so many like roadblocks. At that time, were you missing teaching? Were you stuck professionally about what you wanted to do? Where were you in these last couple of years after we split professionally? What were you wanting to do, and where were you as far as life goals?
I had taken all the exams for teaching, but I don't remember if I had taken them all. But like the ones that I needed to teach for those 2 years, I remember that I started a master's in teaching, but I was not finished. I think. I don't know what kind of program I was in. I don't remember that allowed me to teach while completing the master's. So that's what I was doing. And then when I came back after the whole year that I was in DR, when I came back, I had to finish those classes. And a lot of things changed because then when I go back to Mercy, the program that I was doing, they had changed the program. So I had to take a different program and I need more classes. And it was some situation. And I did want it to, but I wasn't 100% sure that that's really what I wanted.
Right.
And also, I wanted to go back to 176, but a part of me didn't want to go back to 176. So it was something, you know, people asking because I didn't want people to be asking, oh, where were you going and things like that. So I didn't want to put myself in that situation of having to like
explain yourself,
answer that or explain and, you know, people assuming things. And
yeah.
So I did want to go back and I didn't at the same time. It's hard to explain, but that's where I was, like, sort of like in limbo. And then I remember that I did substitute teaching for probably 1 year after that.
You're bouncing around?
Half a year. And I was like district wide. I went to 176. I went to, there was a few other schools in the Bronx that I went to. So
right.
I was not like assigned only to 176.
Right.
So then after that, I got married. I decided to go back into counseling and I got a job doing counseling. So never went back to, I think after that, work it okay. I don't remember. I think I did probably in 2020 something, maybe right around the pandemic, maybe when the pandemic was starting.
Right, right.
I was subbing again.
Before you got married, I remember when we first met, you already had your son. Your son.
He was like 3 years old or something.
Yeah, he was so, now he's a full-fledged man, which means you had him at 2 years old because you were so young. Yeah, you were a young mom, 2 years
yes,
old.
Yes, I had him at two.
I remember him already being the pride and joy of you. Like, you really were like, you were already so proud of him then, and you were always boasting him and speaking about him positively, and you were showing me his maturation as a young baseball player and whatnot. Can you talk to me about you being a young mom and what that was like for you coming up and what you learned as being a young mom?
It was really not that hard because I had my mom and my dad, and that was like the first grandchild. So my mother was working. She was a home attendant when I had my son. And I was making a little bit of money at the Board of Ed as a teacher. You know, it was not great, but it was good. So I told her to stop working, that I was just going to give her a little bit of cashing in there. So she stopped working and she wanted to be with her grandson. You know, that was the first.
Right.
So she quit her job to take care of him. And most of his younger years, he was, that's why I used to travel to DR a lot. I used to go to, every time we had a break, I went to Dominican Republic. And it was mainly because he was there with her and we will be back and forth. So I really, it wasn't hard for me working, going to school, having him because of her and my dad also.
See, I didn't realize that. I didn't realize that your parents were still in DR at the time. So he was out there.
Yeah, they were back and forth. They will go, stay a couple of months, take him with them, come back. That's how it was for like up until he was five. Yeah.
You hear that story a lot, especially the immigrant story about, you know, sometimes you having to be in one country, making the money, sending it back home to your child and to your parents. And my mom dealt with that growing up as well. She had, because in Haiti, you speak French in like, let's say, hospitals, offices, schools. In the street, you speak Creole, but in the offices, you speak the official French language. So because French is a national language in Haiti, a lot of West African countries, the Congo, Sierra Leone, Ivory Coast, they will hire teachers from Haiti or other countries that speak French for work. So I would have, there'd be moments in my mother's life where her father, her aunts and uncles who were teachers, they would go to Africa for a few months to teach. So, you know, there is that dynamic of leaving your kids in one country while you're going elsewhere to make money and come back and forth. Can you explain to me what the feeling is like of like not having your son in the house for a few months? Like, are you going crazy? Do you miss him crazy? Or are you like, whatever, my mom's watching him, it's all good?
No, I think for me that the experience was different than like many people now, that they are not able to like go back and forth. Because whenever I felt like I had times that, you know, it was Friday and I will get on a plane and go to DR and come back on Monday from the airport, go to work. So I really didn't feel that, you know, like, oh my God, like, you know, I cannot see my child and I have to do this. He was there whenever I got to that point, you know, that I was missing him or whatnot. But I'm very grateful. I'm very thankful for them. But yeah, it was like an optional thing. It was not a necessity to have him there, especially since my mom and dad could also come here to the U.S. It was for their to have them. It was my way of keeping them happy. You know, if they're happy, that kid is going to be happy. I'm going to be able to work. I'm not going to have no stress. So that was the thing.
It was more optional, like you said. It was the best case scenario to have someone to be a caretaker for you. While you were, that's good. That's good. You were blessed then, let me tell you. You were blessed because there's people who have rougher situations where they need to have their children away from them country, you know, in a different country while they make their money. So I'm glad that for you it wasn't as a dire situation, like a crazy situation. I'm glad. Okay, that's interesting. So you had your son and a few years later you get married to your ex-husband. Now what as someone who is a divorcee or divorcee, I think is how you say it, what was marriage like? And like, again, you can only share what you want to share. But what was marriage like, and what do you try to tell people, especially women who have maybe walked your shoes as a married woman or formerly married woman? What can you what was it like for you being married to your children's father? And like I said, what can you give as advice in a situation like maybe that you experienced being married?
Like, I really wanted to be married. Like, I didn't want to, like, my parents were married. They've been married for a long time, over 30-something years. I wouldn't say 40. Not 40, but more than 35 years, I think. They've been married for more than 35 years. And I've seen how they, like, especially as I got older, how they have been, like, you know, ups and downs. A point in my life, I did not want to be married. Like, up until, like, I was living with my son's father when we separated. He was a few months old. And during the whole time, in my mind, I was like, I'm never going to get married. I'm never going to live with somebody. And then after I came back from the yard, I'm with this thing. You know what? Everything changed. And then I'm like, I want to be married. And it got into me. And it lasted about the whole relationship, probably 10 years. We were married for about 8-something years. And for me, it was not an option to, like, save the marriage. But if there was that, I think I would do, like, everything possible to, you know, to save the marriage. As I'm getting older and I'm seeing things, I'm learning that everybody's going to have something. Nobody's perfect. Somebody has some shit going on in their life.
Oh, and, no, it's fine. It's fine.
And, you know, it's whether it's just finding that person that is ready to say, you know what, you're full of shit. You did this. You're doing that. We made a mistake. We're humans. And the point is to fix it and move on. There are some people that are that stay stuck and you know, this is the problem, but, you know, and they're not able to say, you know, this is the problem, but how can we make it better so we can stay together and just get on with our lives? And there are also some things that we put a magnifying glass over that are that are not that big, you know, that are like simple things that can probably, if you just ignore them or you focus on something else, you could be happy and you know, have a semi-healthy relationship, because I don't think super healthy, like I haven't seen, but it's not easy being a single mother.
Not gonna imagine.
It's not. So
you have three or four?
Three. It's not easy. What would I say to people that I marry right now?
Or single mothers.
You know, try to work it. Like, try to, if, you know, both people are on board, no? Single moms, ¿qué te digo? Single moms are doing their thing. So, ¿qué le digo? You know, keep on doing your thing. It's hard. And as time goes by and you get older, I think it gets more difficult to find somebody that really fits your lifestyle. Like right now for me, it's not that I'm a picky person, but like I already have, this system in place and every madness in my life and my kids and the dog and this and that. And, you know, finding somebody that will come and adapt to it, it's not as easy as we're building something together. Everything, I already have my whole thing. And it's going to be very difficult to find somebody that's like, meet me where I'm at and let's do this. And it's hard.
I can imagine. And I like what you said. You said, yeah, at this point in your life, you don't need to build something from the ground up. You've already done enough by yourself where you want someone to meet you where you are and to add to it. But right now, what is an ideal partner for you, would you say right now? I don't know,
like, you know, to be honest with you, like, I do want to have a partner, but sometimes I wake up and I'm like, I don't want to cook today. Buy some fast food for the kids and that's it. I don't do anything. I have days that I do not do anything at all. And then I have other days that I come home and I'm like, it's 10 o'clock and I have my music blasting and I'm cleaning. Or it could be 2 o'clock in the morning and I'm listening to music and having a glass of wine. And things that if you were with somebody else, maybe, you know, this person doesn't like this and you have to accommodate and you know, and house has to be spotless. My house is a mess a lot of the time.
You have three kids.
So it's the kids running around too. Like my younger son, he was diagnosed with autism and he gets loud sometimes. He gets super, super loud. Stomping on the floor, running up and down, and he's happy. And I let him be. But, you know, if I have somebody else coming into the house that will be annoyed by that, that's something that I'm going to have to be thinking about. So I don't know. Maybe somebody who's a man, traditional.
Traditional. What is a traditional man?
I don't believe in this 50-50 shit that's going on right now. I do not. I know my place in society. I know my place in life. And if I'm a wife, I'm going to cook for you. I'm going to clean. I'm going to wash to everything. I'm going to do everything that a woman in the house has to do. Okay. But don't come telling me, oh, you know, I have to pay half of the rent. And this is the thing. You know, I have my own house. How somebody is going to come in and pay like my mortgage? It's going to be difficult, you know?
Right.
Because I don't believe in that. Usted el hombre de la casa, usted paga los biles.
Okay.
So okay. That's another thing that's very difficult nowadays with men that are like, you know?
Well, you know, it's funny you say that because there has been a conversation going on for a while now about a lot of men are lacking professionally. They're not going to school as much. They are not even doing as many trade jobs like they used to, plumbing, mechanic, etc. So a lot of men are being left out of the workforce or a particular salary wage in the workforce, and it's affecting the dating world where, you know, a lot of women, a lot of black and brown women, women in general, are excelling or in the pursuit of excellence professionally, and they're leaving men behind. And it's having this effect of women like yourself who are excelling or on their way, and they can't find a mate to match their speed because that mate is not going to school. It's not trying their best to earn a dollar, and it affects them. So I can see that. I can see that playing out, you know, in today's society. So I understand when I hear you talk about, you know, you already have your mortgage, you already have stuff going on, and you need a man to match your speed. It's, I understand why it might be difficult in the long run to find a guy.
I think, Mike, I don't think it has to do so much with the preparation and the going to trade school and this and that. It's just, my father used to be a taxi driver. So if you don't have the skills, you're going to have to work more hours.
Hustle.
You know, hustle. And I'm going to law school, by the way, I told you.
Yes, yes, we'll get to that.
There's always room for something. So, you know, it's that men nowadays, they don't set the priorities right. And they have too many expectations of women. A lot of men are weak. I don't know what is going on. Because, you know, my father came to this country when he was like 50-something years old. And he used to send money to his kids in Dominican Republic and to his wife. And he tell us stories where, you know, he had to work. He worked in construction. He worked in, you know, different jobs. And then he worked at a nightclub in the nighttime doing, at a bathroom, doing, come on. You remember, like, I don't know if they still have it. I don't go clubbing. I don't much. But, you know, he had like a little stand outside of the men's bathroom with like with different colognes and things. And so that was his night thing. So like he was working nonstop. So if you want a lifestyle, and you know, this is how much I'm going to need, setting goals to, this is what I need, so this is what I have to do. Bust my ass, do this, get this, to maybe work less. But now and this is one of the reasons why I got divorced, because some men like to be comfortable, and they just want to be where they are. You know, the best thing my son tells me, when I moved here to Connecticut, he didn't want to at first. He was like, the first couple of months, I'm going back to my dad, and I'm like, no, you're not. You're not going nowhere. Usted se equivocó. You live here with me and you're not going anywhere. A couple of months later, he tells me that was the best thing you could ever done.
And why is that, you think?
The environment where we were living, like a lot of his friends that he went to middle school with, eighth grade, are dead.
Tigres.
Eso was still like in the streets. He has a lot of friends that he went to school with that are dead. Either committed suicide or have been killed, stabbed in the corner. And my son, when I decided to move here, to Connecticut, he was at a barbershop. He walked to the barbershop. I didn't let him go anywhere by himself. Growing up, he would go to middle school. I would drive him, and it was walking distance. I would drive him, and then I would pick him up. And if I couldn't pick him up, I would send my dad to pick him up. Like, I never had him, like, walking around on the streets. Never. He don't have no tigueraje. Like, now I'm, like, wondering if I did the right thing, because if he finds himself in a situation, I don't know if he's going to be able to, you know? But he was sitting on the barbershop chair, and one guy went in and stabbed another person that was at the barbershop. He's sitting on the chair, and then he came back home, regular time, nothing. He said, Mom, you know this and this happened, and I just froze. I stayed sitting down. I didn't do anything. I'm like, no. You know, if you're a kid, no mother wants their child to die, even if they're like the worst criminal in the world. But I'm not going to let my son die because he's just, you know, right. Otro hijo de la gran puta. No. So I decided to move out here. And I hustled. But my ex-husband, he liked to be comfortable. Like, he didn't have no aspirations.
Like, and I.
He had his job wasn't bad, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is what we would have been. And if we work together, probably, but it's just, if you come home from work at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and you don't want to do anything else in your life and you're young, no sé. It's a problema, you know, then you cannot complain about not having enough money, because every single day prices are going up. So you decide whether you want your income to stay the same or you want to create something, side hustle, go to school, prepare yourself, do whatever you have to do. And it's sacrifice. I went to work 9 to 5. My class started at 6-something, and I finished school at 11 o'clock. At that time, I had to take a train and go home. It wasn't easy. It wasn't that, you know, I know I have to struggle. And on top of that, you know, going to studying, because you have to find the hour, the time to study. Everything is a sacrifice. And I think that people just want to be comfortable now, especially men want to be comfortable.
They
want to be comfortable. So that's the thing. It's nothing about preparation. If everything is out there, If you don't have the income, you could take out a loan. If you don't have the language, you could take classes. There's free everything everywhere nowadays. So it's not even about preparation. It's about being lazy. And that's my opinion, you know, but it's about being lazy.
To your point, yes, there's a lot of living in America, especially in America, there's a lot of resources to take advantage of to better prepare yourself for life. You know, my wife, she actually teaches ESO to people at nighttime. Well, it used to be nighttime, but now it's daytime. So she teaches English to people, to young adults, any adults really, and who want to learn. And, you know, sometimes she'll tell me, like, you know, she knows which students care about their future and really want to take it seriously. And some will just freestyle it just to hang out, whatever. And yes, to your point, listen, I used to live in Dykeman for like a few years in the pandemic. So I knew what it was like to see folks who are outside all day with the music, you know, like I just fuego, 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 just playing music all night long at 3 o'clock in the morning, hanging out, versus the person in the morning working 2 or 3 jobs and making a little side hustle and trying to make themselves better. I saw it all. And to your point, yes, I have heard the complaints from women who in the dating scene today that they are frustrated with the crop of men that are out there right now, because a lot of men apparently, they're just not hustlers. They're not go-getters. They don't have a fire or a drive inside of them. And it seems to me, from what I'm hearing also, they also don't have a lot of emotional intelligence as well. So
emotional intelligence. I was in a dating app some months ago, right? And I dated a few people and you know, I saw un poquito de todo. And there are these men that, you know, the situation that are like making good money, have good jobs, business owners, whatnot, good upbringing. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, that's the part of the emotional intelligence and the communication and just not knowing what you want, just try to date somebody for the heck of not being alone. That's not a good thing either. So,
right.
You know, making people waste their time when you don't really know what you want or if you prepare for it. And that's what I ask people is, you know, are you ready to be in a relationship? When I go dating, I'm not like, oh, let's see what happens. I don't want to see what happens. So if you want to see what happens, go find somebody else to see what happens.
I agree.
This is what I want and this is what I'm looking for. But a lot of men are not comfortable telling a woman
a plan.
You know what? I don't think you're what I'm looking for or whatnot. And then, you know, time goes by and 1 month go by, 2 months. By the time you know it, you spend like a couple of years with this person thinking that, you know, you have something serious and it happens that we were not in the same page or something like that. So it's communication, emotional intelligence more than anything. Men, see, this is my opinion, you know, because some men are not comfortable, are not open also about their finances, and they just want to make the woman believe that they got it like that. And when the time goes by and you see what really is going on, then there is a problem instead of being upfront from the beginning. So men have a lot of insecurities besides the whole thing, and they just want to be comfortable. And part of their insecurities has come with this 50-50 thing. Like, you know, they don't want to be chapeados. But
chapeados.
If you're not ready, you're not ready. So
listen. I think you're saying a lot of interesting, but things I've heard before, good things. And I ultimately agree with you. I say it as a man who's on the other side, listen to other men talk. Like, you just brought up how a lot of men aren't good at being firm about telling a woman that it's not going to work out or that they're not interested. I have seen, since I was a little kid, I've seen men string women along when I could tell, you don't really like her that much, do you? Or you're not really into her. Or it's not going to go well, right? You're not working out, but they don't have the nerve or the balls to be like, listen, I like you and all, but this ain't going to work. You should go your way, I go my way, or you're too good for me, or I'm not ready yet, or whatever. A lot of men would rather just like stay quiet and let it fester and build up, make a woman believe that it's all good when it's not all good. And that only prolongs the eventual drama.
Yeah.
And a lot of men will claim that they're, you know, they're alpha males and they're strong and whatnot. But really, that, like you said, they're insecure inside, they're weak inside, and they don't know how to properly just articulate their plan and who they are. So I agree. My daughter. She's missing me and loving me right now. Say hi. Come here, Charlie. Come here. But I want to also talk to you about you. Speaking of the devil, Charlie's here. She's on the spectrum. She turned 2 in November, last November, so she'll be 3 this year. I want to talk to you about parenthood because you mentioned autism too. Now, let me give you my story. Charlie was born in November 2022. And the first year, she's being a typical baby, you know. And I want to say by the 11th month, October. Maybe that's summer. So 8 months in, I just felt like there are certain milestones and things that she wasn't really getting. Whether it was eye contact, whether it was, it was eye contact, whether it was speech, I wasn't really that on it about. There's a few milestones in general. I felt like something's abnormal. Something's off. And, you know, we and you have that, the background of working where we worked. So we have it in our heads already to look out for certain things. So I also thought to myself, you know, take it easy. Be careful. You're probably in your head too much. But as the months progressed, as a year and 2 months came, I'm like, no, something's not typical. The word I'll use, typical. So her birthday's November. By December, 13 months in, I got evaluated. And that was early. That's pretty early to be evaluated. But when she was evaluated, you know, I guess they do it by percentages, 30%, whatever, 40, whatever they call it, 35%. And they had told me early on, they had a PT come to my house, a physical therapist, I had an occupational therapist, an OT come to my house, and I had a speech therapist come to my house. And definitely the speech therapist who was like, yeah, she may be on the spectrum, but it's too early right now, but she may be on the spectrum. And so same with the PT. So then like the following May, she's like a year and a half, we went to the Kennedy Center and it was confirmed, she was confirmed to be on the spectrum. But by then I knew in my heart, like, okay, she's on the spectrum. She needs help. I need to get services for her ASAP. So by last year, 2024, we started getting the services. So that comes now in the last few months, we've gotten ABA therapy for her. She goes to a school in the morning, 6 a.m. The bus picks her up, 6 a.m. there in Parano. She goes to like a center where like she gets PT, OT, speech. And I've seen improvements. She'll say daddy, stuff like that to me. She always looks for me. She always drags my finger to take her somewhere. She loves the park, loves the playground. She loves Elmo, loves Sesame Street. But there was that initial first few months where we had to like, I don't want to say grieve. That's the wrong word to use, not grieve. But I had to come to the realization like, okay, things are different. And I have to adjust my expectations, my desires, which is ego, you know. There's ego there as a parent. Because even parents can have ego, you know? Wow. And just overall ideas of what a typical parenthood would be. So I want to ask you, what have you learned from being a parent of someone who has special needs? And what can you offer to other parents who also?
I think that having worked with the population for so long made it a little, you know, easier. To accept.
Sure, absolutely.
Because I remember a lot of the times I had conversations with the parents, you know, you need to understand your son is not going to be a doctor, especially for the kids that were like, you know, we were in middle school already and the kid was struggling to write. We're not talking about high functioning autism. And coming to that realization that, you know, my child, we all have dreams as parents and we all wish that, oh, my son is going to be this. I want my son to be that. But accepting that, you know, this is it. My son wasn't diagnosed until a few months ago. Mm. But I knew from like maybe age 2, I had him evaluated and he was diagnosed with speech delay. Then after that, he was diagnosed with ADHD and then recently. But I knew because he had all these behaviors. He's verbal. He's able to speak. But, you know, then he had this all the things, the symptoms. And it's just, you know, accepting and meeting them where they are and loving them how they are. For me, my son, when he was born, he had a pulmonary vein was clogged.
Really?
Well, he had a procedure done about 5 days after he was born on his heart. So to me, you know, as long as he's alive, I don't care if what he does or what he is, if he's able to speak, as long as he's alive, I just want him to be alive and be happy. And that's the most important thing for me, for him to be happy and, you know, be treated well, have good experiences. But it's hard. Sometimes, you know, when you're frustrated at work and you have so much going on and you get that phone call from school that your child did this, and then you have to run to do some meeting and you have to do this and that. Sometimes it takes a toll on you. But I created the environment in the home specifically for him so that I don't have to make sure that he doesn't hurt himself, make sure that he's doing this or he's doing that. He could run, he could do whatever he wants at home. But it's, at first, you know, it's been difficult, especially being a single parent. All these appointments, this specialist, the OT and the speech and this and that.
First of all, you're right when you say because of our background professionally, we had a better shot at accepting it early on, which I felt the same way. I agree. I knew before my wife that I was able to articulate to my wife, what's going on, I believe. Look out for this, look out for that. This is what you need to be aware of. That's going on. And be alert and be aware and look out for this process. And, you know, if you have a partner or someone in your life, whether it's a parent or whoever, who's not used to it, they may feel hold out like, well, I don't know. Well, and they try to create a false sense of, not hope, that's the wrong word, but a false sense of like idea about your child's current capabilities or current abilities. And by the way, we are not here to limit our children, spectrum or not. You never know what they can and can't do down the line, you know. But in the moment, you have an idea of, okay, this is what they're going through. This is the areas they need help with or to work on. And me and you being professionally have that experience, we are able to deal with the reality of things faster and grasp the reality faster. So for me, I was able to adapt quicker to helping Charlie, to advocating for Charlie. And oh, there's moments early on, I just felt, you know, like, you know, a little sad in the beginning. But I got over it. I was like, no, like what's done is done. Like, and like you said, the most important thing is that she's having a quality of life that she's appreciating, that she's loving, and that she's appreciating. And let me tell you, this girl, she's a sweetheart. She loves me to death. Like, I can't go anywhere without her. Like, she's just always looking for me. She doesn't go outside. So like, let's say the other day I got her ready to go to the park. She walks out the house. I have the door open and she's at the elevator and she's just ready to press the button. She's saying, dad, she's like ready, like rushing me, you know, to go outside. And all she wants is to hang out with me and have fun. So, you know, I know that she's enjoying life. She may not be able to articulate it like I can, but I know she's enjoying herself and that she just wants to have fun and live a good life. So it's my duty to bring that to her. You know what I'm saying? So I definitely get where you're coming from. And to your point, yes, as an educator for the last 15 years, we also had the experience of telling, of letting parents know, like, you know, meet your children where they are at to improve with them. But, you know, you can't have these grand ideas about.
Give me a second, Mike.
No, sure. But you can't have these grand ideas about who you think they're going to be because you create a false sense of reality, you know? So I'm glad you shared that with your experience. I know I'm going to leave soon. But before I leave, you were telling me how you want to go to law school and you're going to start law school soon. Before law school.
Tomorrow.
Already.
I start classes tomorrow.
Oh, snap. Tomorrow. I didn't realize tomorrow you start class. Wow. Welcome. Well, before you start law school, for the past few years, you've been consulting.
For the past 5 years.
5 years. You've been consulting. And a lot of your client base has been immigrants. Can you give me an overall idea of what it's like servicing the immigrant community before and especially now the last few months with a change of administration? What has the dynamic been like?
So when I told you that I in 2014 I went back to I was doing counseling, I was working for a program funded by DHS, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and accompanying minors. I'm sure you heard, the children that enter the you was alone without mom or dad, are considered unaccompanied, even if they came with uncle or somebody or different adults. If mom and dad were not with them at the time they entered, they were considered unaccompanied minors. And so they were taken into custody and they were placed in foster care and also on group homes, especially for children. So I worked at an agency in New York, Manhattan, that offer foster care, transitional foster care for these children. And my job was to do psychological evaluation and provide counseling. And then based on that assessment, I will make recommendations on reunification, whether or not we thought that it was safe for the child to reunite with mom, dad, whoever it is that they have waiting for them here in the U.S., or if something else had to be done. I had one child that had to be returned back to Mexico too, because she didn't have somebody here. It was a very sad story. That's the reason why I decided not to continue working in that area. But when I was there, I was the time that the gangs, MS-13, were like really, really a big thing in El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala. And I heard so many sad stories with these little girls, these boys, things they had to go through in their countries, things they had to go through during their journey to the U.S. to, you know, be here with mom, be here with dad, be here with whoever it is that was waiting for them, but to be safe. So when I left that, I decided to help in a different way, to help the mom that, you know, is paying a food guide to bring the child in, to get papers so that she can petition for the child and the child could come in here legally. So that was my main thing when I decided to come into the immigration field, to help those people that have been here for a couple of years undocumented get papers so that they could bring their family through the legal pathway. What is different previous administration to this administration?
Yeah.
You know, it's imagine fish. They were fish. Now they have a shark behind them. So now they're moving. So this is causing people that have been here 20, 30, 40 years undocumented to do something about it.
Wow.
To, you know, look for, because they want to stay here. Like I have clients that if they go back to whatever country they came from, they're not going to find mom. They're not going to find dad. They're not going to find friends because they've been out of the country for so long that everybody either has moved or they have done their own thing. So there is a lot of people here that they are deported and they're not going to have anything or anyone to go back to. More than anything, anyone. That's, you know, it's even worse than not having anything. And so now this is causing them to, and this is what I'm seeing. This is causing them, the money suddenly, está apareciendo el dinero, you know? They're doing what they have to do to get the money, to find different ways to, and now there's more education also. There's like more resources for them and they for them to, you know, get information and all the different options that they have. There are so many different ways that people can get green card here in the U.S. that a lot of people didn't know and they still don't know, but more knowledge is being spread.
Right,
and
right.
Now that they have this chart behind them, they are forced to go and seek advice. And they're learning that, oh man, I should have, I didn't know that, you know, in 2008, I was able to do this and this and that. They didn't know that in 2015, I was able to do this and this and that. I have people with auto removal from 2008, 2014. And, you know, with a proof, I-130 petitions that they could have applied for a waiver or they could have done this or that to, you know, gain legal status here. They didn't know. And because they were so comfortable, they didn't have the need to go in,
right.
But now they do.
Yeah, now they do.
So it's, you know, I don't like to comment so much on that because it's good for some and bad for some, but I don't know. I think everything is going to be all right.
I think so. I'm hopeful, you know.
And you know, this is something that I have in 2014. I lived through that, you know, at work. We heard stories of, you know, from the children. ICE coming into the homes, picking up people. There were so many people being deported back then. Nobody knew. And the difference is that this person that we have now, habla mucho, you know, everybody's here. But maybe he's not doing anything that hasn't been done in the past. But
right.
Como él habla mucho, you know, everybody's thinking, we got this. But, you know, it gives them at least an opportunity to get prepared, not just,
right.
Como dicen que en guerra avisada no muere soldado, right? You know what that means?
Muere enseñado.
En guerra avisada, no muere soldado. So you know, he's letting people know what he's going to do. So people at least have an opportunity to get prepared. And this is all the cause of a big mess. They did a whole mierdero hicieron during the pandemic, you know? So now they're trying to fix that. And it's all their fault. It's not la culpa de la gente que están aquí. So that's basically what's going on. And I don't know if I agree with it, but I don't disagree either. So I'm like, no.
Right, right. Well, to your point, yes, it's making people in a faster manner know their rights, know their status, and to act fast and act accordingly and to get their stuff together, their ish together. So, you know, there's always a silver lining in chaos, you know? There's always a way to know, okay, this is where we stand. And to your point, yes, this has been going on before the big bad shark was in the water. It was quieter back then. Okay, okay. And now you're going into law. Why law? Why are you going to law school? Why?
Everybody call me doctora, licenciada, abogada. So I'm like, okay. So it's just for that. It's because I'm doing already my clients. So my concentration here is humanitarian based on visas. I do a lot of AWA, a lot of T visas, U visas. My clients, almost 85% to 90% are in removal proceedings or already have an order of deportation going on. So that's what my focus is. And I want to be able to, I don't know, help them more. Not that I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing or anybody else can do, but it's just so that, I don't know, I think it's for me that I'm doing it.
Right. I get it. And I respect you the more for it. You know, over the weekend, I saw my friend from Philadelphia. He's an entertainment lawyer. I knew him before law school. So I watched his growth. And I have another friend of mine. You know him. Shout out to Jeff. And he is he's a defense attorney. He was previously a prosecutor, and now he's a defense attorney. So he does litigation for my boy, Ryan, who is an entertainment attorney. He doesn't do litigation. And I asked him the other day, like, how come you didn't want to do litigation? He was like, that's not my thing. I don't want to be in the courtroom. I don't want to do none of that. I just want to do paperwork. I want to just, you know, do contracts, paperwork, and advocate for people, for clients, you know, at home or at my office, but I don't want to be in the courtroom dealing with people. What do you foresee yourself being someone to be in the courtroom litigating for clients, or do you want to do like actual just immigration law and stuff behind the scenes?
Yeah, I love to be in court, but immigration court. No litigation, no, just immigration.
I can see you doing that. I can see you doing that. And I have an idea. And the same way I saw you 15 years ago at 15 years old, you know, being a great teacher, the same way I saw you back then as a young lady being a great teacher, I only can assume that you'll do the same thing plus more as an attorney, as a lawyer. So I believe in you. I trust you. And I can't wait to see what the future holds from you. Before you go, can you give people your consultant professional information on your number, et cetera, in case any clients who see this or potential clients need to want to reach out or need someone like you to advocate for them? Is there anything you could share with them as far as numbers or places to reach you at or anything like that?
Maybe yes.
Where can they reach you?
So my office is in Hartford, Connecticut. But I also have an office. It's remote. I go to New York. I see clients in New York. And I go to New York 2 times a month. So I have a space there. It's like more like a little conference room that I use from time to time. 59 and Park Avenue.
Nice.
But I'm here in Hartford, a few minutes from the court, like walking distance to the court, to the immigration court. And we have an Instagram account. It's Jencat. That consulting.
Jencat.
That consulting.
I'll make sure I put the link in here when people.
And then I have a office number.
Good, good, good. Use that number. Look up on Instagram if you need any consultation or a family member who needs consultation or any advice. And I'm sure in a few years, if you want to hire her straight up as an attorney, you'll get to do that, have that privilege as well. I believe in her. But until that time, you can always rewind and play this episode. Okay. By then, she'll only be 42 years old. the next time you see her.
So what are you talking about? I'm going to be 17.
Okay, that's right. Be 17. Well, anyway, Jenny, thank you from the block. Thank you so much, Jenny from the block. Until next time. All right. I'll talk to you later. All right. Later.